Found Manuscript by David Lindblad. Read by Wayne June. Authorities discovered the following manuscript, bloodstained, under the deceased body of a man on October 29, 1929. Scratches and gouges of a singular nature marred the walls and floor around the corpse where it lay in the filthy room of a run-down boarding house. The existence of this memoir, and the fact that its author clearly ended his own life with a single shot from an automatic pistol, gives evidence that this man was, to a greater or lesser degree, mentally disturbed. Inquiries had thus far unveiled nothing as to the man's identity. He had rented the room where he died under a false identity, and investigators found no documents containing his name or address. This narrative shall be published in an effort to identify this man, providing it is not a wholly fictional account, formulated in a diseased mind. A man once wrote, "We live on a placid island of ignorance in the midst of black seas of infinity, and it was not meant that we should voyage far." Though that man's name escapes me presently, his words ring true. I no longer believe in a benevolent figure that keeps watch over us in any form. It has been said that man was given free will, though he may ask a higher power for support and guidance, but there can be no such merciful entity. No guardian creator of humanity would allow such things to exist. I have vainly beseeched such deities to efface from my mind a horror I dare not speak of aloud. The hints I did let fall to the alienists were dismissed as the product of an overwrought nervous system, but they were the truth. And I fear the blasphemies I have endured may soon drive me to madness after all. I have lost everything, and will never know the slightest semblance of peace for the rest of my days on this planet. Word of warning to any who find this chronicle of events upon my losing it, or worse, upon my demise, burn this manuscript to ashes and speak of it to no one. At the beginning of the summer of 1928, I was hired on as a teller at the Westing & Sons Bank, the oldest in the region and located in its original structure, erected on or about January 1, 1867. It was an establishment of the finest standing in the city of Elmstrom, Pennsylvania. I gained my employment after an acquaintance, one Mr. Joseph Warren, noticed my congenial nature and eagerness to achieve in all my financial exploits. I began work promptly at 9 a.m. on the morning of May 14th, under the tutelage of the branch manager himself. My role as protégé did not last long, for I fancied myself a quick study, able to remember details of a situation with relative ease. I found myself much at home dealing with money, something I had always relished in my youth and beyond. My duties included account deposits, withdrawals, transfers, and what I would later regret to this day: the overseeing of safe deposit boxes. The first weeks passed without incident. I was prompt, efficient, and, due to my vigilance, was never a penny short, which granted me prestige over my peers. Several nights a week I would visit a local speakeasy called The Mash by its goers, accompanied by some of my closer work companions and friends. I found the illegality of this activity far more thrilling than the taste or imbibing of alcohol. This and the camaraderie of my fellows accounted for my not infrequent visits. My life was placid, quiet, and enjoyable, with nothing of fear or discomfort in it, save for the occasional threats of raids on my cherished haunt. Joseph became one of my closest friends, and I confided in him about many things. We spoke of matters of love, business, and social affairs. I also shared with him some of my more daring hypotheses concerning the evolution of man and his place in the universe. Much to my delight, he was not put off by my musings, and even offered up a few of his own. I had at the time been seeing a young woman with more than social intent, whom I very much cared for. She was a beauty that appealed to me on more than just the physical level. Her education had been in Europe among the finest teachers of art and philosophy. Dark amber curls cascaded about her shoulders, for she did not partake of the shorter hairstyles, often popular with the flappers and more daring socialites. We met one day when she came into the bank to discuss some business and tend to the finances of her recently deceased father. I offered my sympathies and extended my service in any capacity during her time of grief. She introduced herself as Catherine Kane and became a frequent patron of the bank. This resulted in my subdued displays of affection as not to seem overzealous and perhaps cause her to find distaste in my advances. Invitations to accompany me to the MASH were inevitable, and my callings upon her became more and more frequent. She would hold me captivated for hours as we talked of literature, the theater, and politics. I had found in this beautiful girl a kindred spirit. On a particularly warm day in September, just as I had finished a sizable deposit from the town's doctor, the object of my affections entered the bank lobby. She wore an inquisitive look and grasped at something within her pocket. After polite greetings, I asked her what seemed to be the matter. She produced an old key on the end of a long silver chain. Apparently, whilst organizing the last of her father's personal effects, she found the key wrapped in a small piece of parchment tied with a ribbon. With the key removed, she found a number written on the parchment. I took the key for closer inspection and recognized it as a safe deposit box key from an older section of the vault. After a moment's search, I discovered the box was older than I had anticipated. It was about a foot wide and roughly 2 feet long. We removed the box and placed it on the table to view its contents. I asked if she would like to be left alone to explore the contents, but she bid me to stay for comfort in case she would become overwhelmed viewing her late father's personal effects. I agreed and stood close by as she lifted the lid. We both peered inside. The contents were at first unremarkable, being a collection of letters from various persons, an old pocket watch engraved with her father's name, and a rather newish-looking camera. With each item produced, I could feel her emotions beginning to get the better of her and suggested a brief respite from this activity that so obviously caused her pain. She took a deep breath and said she'd rather continue. The next items, had I known their significance, should have been destroyed. Catherine removed a large envelope containing a series of photographs. These were of a truly puzzling nature, for the outlines of the subject captured on the film appeared marred either by time or a shaky hand behind the lens. The objects in these photographs looked vaguely anthropomorphic, though one could discern little from the blurry snapshots. One quality of these figures chilled me for reasons I couldn't quite place. Namely, that a strange light effect manifested in what appeared as large eyes glowing as though an obscure fire burned behind them. I at once dismissed these photographs as hoaxes intended to shock the viewer into seeing demons or some other malign presence. I had judged by the look of confusion in Catherine's eyes that she did not read into them what I had. With the photographs placed back into the envelope, she next removed a parchment manuscript in her father's most recent hand. The title on the cover, written in Latin, read, Horrore sub terra. Having studied the dead tongue, I knew immediately what it said, and shuddered inwardly. This volume intrigued me so much that I asked if I might thumb through it while she examined the other articles left in the box. As she pulled more objects from the aperture, I quickly realized what I was looking at was a study or observation of things altogether esoteric and frightening. Disturbing passages opposite graphic and horrible images met my eyes on every page, and a cold sweat broke out upon my brow. Why had her father crafted such an odd collection of writings and in so close a proximity to his demise? The room around me faded into obscurity as I turned the thick pages, revealing more and more horrors. These passages in Latin hinted at things I had not even dared think of in my wildest moods of speculation. My heart scarcely continued to beat at the little I gathered. Nothing in all my years had ever had such a strong effect on me. I then became aware of someone gripping my shoulder and shaking me briskly. My eyes focused and I came to back in the vault, being tussled about, hearing Catherine calling my name. When I looked about, I saw her staring back at me. She asked if I felt all right, and I said I would be fine, that I had just allowed my stray thoughts to get the better of me. Clearing my head and regaining composure, I inquired as to what she planned to do with these articles of her father. She took a moment in thinking and decided to have the whole collection moved to her home on Empire Street. As it was very near the end of my shift, I offered to escort her home, to which she cheerfully agreed. I acquired a taxi, and before long we pulled into the driveway of a stately old mansion that I learned belonged to her late father. I gathered up the box in my arms and followed her up a small flight of cobbled steps leading to a six-paneled oaken door. She pushed the door open and led me through the threshold. The collections of various books and objects from the furthest and most ancient corners of the earth amazed me at once, though I promptly set the box down on a table and bid my hostess good day, not wanting to seem too forward in my staying. We said our goodbyes and I headed for the door, and something made me stop in my tracks and ask about the collection of parchment and photographs. I realized how unseemly the request sounded, but I asked if I might borrow them for closer study. As the words left my mouth, I felt that I had overstepped proper etiquette and retracted my inquisition immediately. Without saying a word, she retrieved the manuscript and photographs, claiming she could not make heads or tails of the writing and that I was welcome to the volume for as much or as little time as I needed. I blushed and took the items with profuse thanks and expressed my interest in them as a source of genealogical artifacts that thoroughly fascinated me. I again bid her farewell and departed, feeling a touch of excitement tinged with fear that stemmed from the objects I now carried with me. In truth, it took me some time before I could devote my attention to the manuscript to decipher its message and determine the reason its author constructed it. I found the initial attraction of the objects quickly dissipated amongst the eventfulness of everyday life. Though I never wholly put the book out of my mind, I found it difficult to peer into a tome of such unquestionable malevolence. The opportunity to study the manuscript arose, however, when, due to my exemplary performance at the bank, I was granted a short paid holiday. I sat at my walnut desk, gazing at the cover of the book. It seemed almost to mock me as it leered up from the desk. I collected myself and pulled the electric desk lamp closer to the text and began to translate from the Latin colloquy to English syllables. I shall recount the introductory paragraphs as best I can from memory. I have since then destroyed my translation, fearing it should be discovered by some hapless reader. The opening paragraphs read something like this. I have seen my greatest dreams transformed into my deepest regrets. As a young man, I built my fortune and traveled the globe, gathering all that I could in the realms that interested me. I have learned much about our world, and I fear now that I may have learned too much, or perhaps not enough. In my later years, I strove to make a name for myself with the construction of the most lavish and comfortable subway system this town or any other has ever seen. Through some cruel twist of fate, my dreams were warped and corrupted by something I dare not classify. I have tried the best I could to rectify my mistakes and put down that which I had unwittingly called up. I fear, though, my efforts were inadequate, and that all of humanity shall pay for my ambitions. This log will chronicle what I have learned and may serve to aid those who discover it against all that may come. Life to me seems frivolous, humanity the merest grains of sand in a cosmic desertscape, but I must protect it. Recent events suggest a ghastly fate in store for me, but for what it may be worth, I must complete this log. I have made use of the Latin tongue to ensure my daughter receives no hint at its meaning. At least not right away. Please, I beg whoever finds this, find proof positive that I have not failed, and that if I have failed, do what must be done. After translating this passage, my mind reeled and questions filled my head. No one, to my knowledge, ever constructed or attempted to construct a subway in Eldstrom. What had this man called up from the bowels of inner earth? What had given this man such a fright that he would fear for his life and the life of all mankind? I detected no hint of irony or satire in the text, nor could I wholly write off what I had read so far as the simple ravings of a person greatly overtaxed by unseen forces. The words carried with them a profound denotation of truth, so that I felt inclined to believe them despite my strong skepticism. I sat back in my high-rolling chair, wondering if I may have perhaps traipsed down a vista I was ill-equipped to travel. After careful reasoning, I concluded that this text must surely be a work of fiction, and that its existence, along with the photographs, were conceivably a brilliant work in modern horror writing, and perhaps another facet of her father's nature. Having fully 4 days before I was scheduled back on duty, I had ample time to continue deciphering the pages. Soon, time ceased to carry meaning, and I found myself spending hours upon hours foregoing sleep and food in favor of the transcription. I could scarcely be torn away and only left my apartment when Catherine arrived on a social call. With the passing of Catherine's father some months in the past, I figured my asking about certain particulars regarding the man would not overly distress her. She described him as a captain of industry, making his fortune in the manufacturing of goods such as petroleum, tapestries, farming machines, men's hats, and, to a lesser extent, hand tools. I remarked at the eclectic and varied interest of his businesses, and she said his moods were so that he would never find satisfaction in one enterprise for very long. Apparently he desired to have his name read in history books and to preserve his legacy and family name. He feared passing into obscurity and lamented any failed endeavors. This sentiment reflected itself in his manuscript, and I pressed on to find out if at any point he had acted strangely or mentioned his plans for the subway. Catherine said she'd not been aware of the subway venture, although this was not uncommon. She had little interest in business, and her father rarely spoke of his endeavors with her. I resolved to investigate the matter of the subway within the town records, and decided to ask no more of Catherine, so as not to let on any hints of my current study. The rest of the evening passed pleasantly, though I could not shake from my mind all that I had learned in the past few days. I had translated more than 3/4 of the manuscript when the state of my fatigue began to show itself to me. I would find myself awakened from various night gaunts, rising swiftly from the desk to find my papers strewn about the room. The nameless driving force pushing me onward did not abate, and more often I awoke at my desk with half-remembered scenes of obscure horror. This circumstance I found most unnerving, simply because I had resolved to absorb as little of the text as I could during translation, and only devour it in its entirety upon its completion. I reasoned simply that I had subconsciously gained fragments of data that colored my dreams and reinforced my need to continue in this task. Having finally completed the decoding of the volume with nearly 2 days left on my holiday, I decided to not immediately read the translation, but to rest and allow my mind freedom from anything to do with the task that had so obsessed me. That night I took to bed with me a small notebook, for I had decided to make a log of my dreams to learn what I could of these fleeting nightmares that seemed never to stake claim on my conscious memory. My ascribed plan was, upon waking, to immediately begin writing all that I remembered at the instant I was emancipated from the dark expanses of my mind. Then, should the images fade from my mind, I could refer back to the journal and reclaim what I had lost. The sun streamed through my window, waking me around 8 in the morning, and I arose with an amount of disappointment. It seemed I had slept soundly through the night, not rising once from visions, frightful or otherwise. Though my inability to record my dreams disappointed me, I felt grateful that I had not been plagued by disproportionate figures lurking in dark spaces. As I rose from the bed and stretched in an effort to remove any remaining sleepiness, I inadvertently knocked my notebook to the floor. When I looked down, a shock met my eyes, for the notebook that I had placed on my bed table the night before had been completely devoid of writing. As I reached down to retrieve the book, I saw it had fallen open and was filled with script, though hasty and somewhat disheveled. That was unmistakably my own. When I picked up the book, I found that the vast majority of it was comprised of symbols I was not familiar with in the least, and that the words that had been scribed in English yielded very little information regarding my dreams. Enigmatic fragments or phrases such as, "from below," "they will come up from depths," and "sealed within," appeared sporadically throughout, giving only the vaguest hints to the meaning of my ramblings. The air of mystery surrounding the events occurring to me and what had happened to Catherine's father captivated me, but I had no evidence to draw any conclusions thus far. An abundant lack of answers bound me and would not slacken its grip until I had received some enlightenment. Perhaps this was a mystery that could, or should, never be solved. Perhaps I was simply wasting my time on a fool's errand, but has not history been fraught with unanswerable questions? All such mysteries have a following of enthusiasts dedicated to their resolution, though they may never hope to attain more than theory or informed speculation. If this were my fate, so be it. But I knew I must push as far as I possibly could, and continue pushing until all my avenues were exhausted. My next step was to gather information from the town's records and surmise whether or not there had actually been an attempt made at a subway system. In my mind, it seemed logical that if there was no record or file of such an event, presumably, the manuscript was indeed a work of fantasy and I could conceivably end my search for answers. So, placing my illegible dream works alongside the parchment on my desk, I readied myself for my inquisition. A greatly aged gentlewoman guided me to the public records of permits and licenses for the last 20 years. I thanked her profusely and began my search. I could only guess at the year construction would have taken place, because the narrative did not mention any dates. It had to have been close enough to the man's death that it was still on his mind, but far enough in the past to have been overshadowed in the public's mind by more other topical news. My undertaking was going to be long and tedious, but I decided to look between the years 1918 through 1923. With public opinions and moods changing swiftly, I figured something of this sort would have been in and out of the public mind within 5 to 10 years. An hour had elapsed, and I was still no closer to my object than when I had begun. A mixture of relief and dissatisfaction stirred in my breast. Perhaps there was no validity to Mr. Kane's story, and my curiosity was to be rewarded with nothing. 3 full hours passed before I had made any sort of progress. I ruled out the years 1923 and 1922 after a thorough search of each. I then combed the files marked 1921 for 15 minutes, with nary a trace of a permit for anything larger than an apartment building. Closing the files and slamming my palms upon the tabletop, I shoved the folder and all of its contents to the floor with a massive exhalation of frustration. Moments later, the same gentlewoman who had shown me in appeared in the doorway of the viewing room and asked if there was something the matter. Feeling quite foolish, I apologized and made some excuse about banging my knee upon the table. I bent down, blushing, to gather the papers I had scattered about the wooden floor. The woman said that should I need any assistance, she would be more than willing, and I again apologized for the disturbance, but I assured her I would require none. The old woman took her leave of me, and I continued to scoop papers into my arms and place them back on the table. It was then that chance placed before me what my searching had been unable to unearth. In the midst of the mass of papers, one particular sheet caught my eye, a sheet with a partially obscured gold seal from the mayor's office. I knew this seal was reserved for special or abnormally large public works. Snatching this document from the jumble of others, I indeed beheld the permit and license for a subway system in the town of Elstrom proper. I felt a sense of triumph at having succeeded, but soon it was overshadowed by the realization that the old man's manifesto had at least some grain of truth in it. With great haste, I gathered the fallen documents and returned them to the folder without heeding categorization. I slipped the permit into the valise I had brought along and left the records office, feigning lament over my failure to find what I had sought. I hurried home with my hat pulled low so as not to attract attention from those I knew on the street to add the permit to my obsessive collection. Spread out before me in my study was the sum of a man's life work, or at least what consumed his life at the end. I examined the latest addition to my collection. The certificate had the signature of the mayor at the time and bore the date February 23, 1921, just as I had expected. The date placed the beginning excavation in the early spring, 7 years ago. This was more than enough time for any native to have lost interest in the attempted project. It was also no wonder that I had not heard of the venture, for until 3 years ago I lived in Ipswich, Massachusetts. Part of me remembered that this had only proven the most prosaic bit of what Mr. Kane's manuscript comprised. Always a skeptic, I surmised that it might have been pure fancy based around a factual past event. I would like to say that this formed the majority of my feelings, though I trusted in the legitimacy of the whole story more than I admitted to myself. My next move was clear: to read and digest fully the text I had spent so much time deciphering. As the dusk dissolved into night, I seized my deciphered manuscript and sat in my high-backed chair under the electric reading lamp. I steeled myself for something I had only been given horrible hints and glances upon. I slowly opened the volume and began to read. What was unveiled before my eager eyes was something holy, not of this world. What I held in my hands was an unbelievable chronicle of a man's dream gone horribly wrong, In late September of 1921, it seems, the excavation crew for the new subway had hit upon a large slab of unidentifiable bedrock. It stretched on for yards and would not succumb to any device they set against it. Progress was halted as the head of the project, no less than Catherine's father himself, tried to formulate a plan. He refused to allow something so trivial to keep his name out of the history books. Finally, Mr. Kane decided that a large gasoline-powered drill would be shipped to the site, as it would surely make short work of the obstruction. He went on to explain that he would accompany the drill himself to make sure that no other complication held up progress. The drill arrived ahead of schedule, which was viewed as a good omen for the matter, but this optimism was short-lived. The apparatus was set in place and given the all-clear. The rotary head was set to the stone. The machine acted as if under appreciable strain, and all hands worked to ensure that it did not move from its mark. The stone slab resisted unaccountably against the large machine as it bit and chewed at the surface. 10 minutes elapsed, and no significant progress had been made. The motor of the machine rattled and roared as if it were about to shake itself to fragments. Thick smoke poured out of the housing, and the order was given to shut it down. Every spectator was dumbfounded, save for Mr. Kane, who shouted and waved his fists about in impotence. 8 men and the drill operator stood about the drill awaiting further instruction when from below was heard a deep groan as from the shifting of great rock plates. The men looked down, noticing a hairline crack spreading as they watched. Once again a titanic groan echoed through the underground chamber, shaking the men visibly. Again. All was quiet, a look of fright on every face. All at once the ground fractured and split, hurling chunks of stone in all directions. The slab gave way, pulling the 9 men and the drill into a black aperture within seconds. The men, having not even enough time to react or scream, disappeared from sight. All others present moved to the edge of the yawning black abyss. Powerful electric searchlights were shone down into the darkness, but nothing definite could be discerned. Shouts into the void were only answered by ebbing echoes, implying the worst had happened. Mr. Kane ordered 3 men to bring back as much rope as they could find, as well as electric lamps and torches. In the interim, all they could do was wait. More shouts were directed down into the void as searchlights moved about, straining to illuminate the cavern, but all was of no use. Soon the ropes had been retrieved and were tied off to metal spikes driven into the walls. All the men, save for 3, to tend to the ropes, gathered round to descend and find out what had become of the hapless victims. One of the first to take up the rope and enter the aperture was Mr. Kane himself, being a man of action and having his fortune at stake. Accompanied by 2 more workmen, they began lowering themselves downward to ascertain the fate of the fallen. As the climbers ventured further and further into the darkness, they stopped at odd intervals and flashed their pocket torches around, searching for any evidence of the fallen men or the machine. The extent of this underground grotto was fantastic, and the rescuers soon feared that the long hempen lines that had been hurled down would not reach any sort of footing or base. Still onward they plummeted into the dank chasm, finding no sign of the men. One of the rescuers flashed his light downward and alerted the party that he had seen a stone landing, though the rope's ends hovered nearly 5 feet above it. They pressed on, deciding whether to risk the short drop from the rope and to later erect something that would bring the ropes within their grasp. The men were about 40 feet above the landing when a chill in the air caught them off guard, and each one remarked of the significant drop in temperature. With stiffening joints, the men's progress was slightly hindered. There was something odd about the odor of this lower depth as well. The air held within its amalgam a quality somewhat of freshness, but also a hint of decay. With every inch that the men descended, the mixture seemed to shift more and more toward the latter quality. One of the men suggested that perhaps this cave ran under the nearby cemetery and crypt, and that its inhabitants' emanations had filled this space over the years. This explanation seemed plausible, but there was something more behind it, some slight hint of malignancy that was carried on the drafts. The first 3 men reached the cusps of the ropes and dropped to the stone floor with an appreciable thud. Here they found the odor waxed intolerable, and they held handkerchiefs to their noses to block what they could of it. More and more of the party dropped from the hanging lines, and within a few minutes the rest of the group had assembled. The workers gathered around Mr. Kane, some men striking matches to light the torches they had carried, while others flashed around the beams of their electric searchlights. One man among them gasped, and the rest turned their attention to what he had reacted to. As they turned, their beams of light played upon the mangled remnants of the drilling apparatus, surrounded by crimson pools of various sizes and shapes. The bodies of those who had fallen were nowhere to be seen. As the party stared wide-eyed at the scene, they feverishly chattered and asked where the fallen workers could have gone. The pools of congealing blood that encircled the demolished machine seemed queer to the man. There was an odd amount of smearing in what may have been footprints, though they overlaid one another and had been obscured to the point of not even appearing to have been applied by human feet. The prevailing hypothesis was, after falling, those who could walk assisted those who couldn't in an effort to explore the cavern, and were now very possibly lost within its labyrinthine corridors. Mr. Kane had taken charge, barking orders for three of the men to gather any materials they could and build some type of ramp or platform that would allow them to regain a grip on the ropes. The rest, a total of seven, would accompany him in the exploration of the cave and search for their missing comrades. The search party followed the quasi-footprints, but they had given out quickly so that only a general direction could be ascertained from them. Many in the company complained of the frigid air and foul smell as they trekked onward through collections of stalactites and stalagmites. Dripping water echoed from the stone walls, and nitre coated the stones around dark puddles. Something in the air made the torches burn low, so the majority of light was produced by the electric searchlights. After 3/4 of an hour, the batteries feeding the lamps had grown weak, and the group was forced to turn back, empty-handed. There was no sign of the missing men, and without trail tape they could not proceed at all. Soon the electric torches waned and gave out one by one, leaving only the low-burning flames to light their egress. With the idea of rescue out of the question, the men now had clearer minds and began to notice peculiarities about the chamber that seemed to denote unnatural forces at work. Deep scratches were distributed in an odd fashion about the floor and stone walls. It was as if some edged weapon had been sharpened on various surfaces about the rock corridors. This phenomenon only added to the uneasiness of the men at hand. No natural geological action could have produced such singular results in the bedrock. The men whispered to each other about what may have done this, but no man dared speak of it aloud. After a few more minutes' travel, some bizarre white fragments shone in the light of the low flickering flames. The crew gathered round to shed more light upon the things sitting white and grim in a pile of rocks. Upon further examination, they appeared to be bones, although they had been badly crushed or smashed upon the stones that lay around them. This did not cause too great of an alarm, for some wandering animal may have well found passage down to these depths, gotten lost, and been crushed in an underground flood or rock slide. These explanations, however, were wiped clear and replaced with dread when a skull was found among the pieces of slate. The skull possessed qualities not one man of the group had ever bore witness to. It was smaller than a man's skull, but resembled one in its basic shape. The mandible was missing, and there seemed to have been a blow to the back of the skull as if from some cudgel or club. The feature that excited the greatest fear in the men was the placement and shape of the eye sockets. They were enormous in proportion to the rest of the skull and were spread apart farther than one would expect. What further threw the men into frenzy was what resided in the mouth of the creature. Only a few teeth remained in the upper portion of the maxilla, but those teeth struck fear into all that viewed them. They were nearly an inch long and were sharp as razors. The outer edges were serrated and appeared to grow in every direction. The rows of hollow sockets reminded one of the parts of a shark's jaw. Mr. Kane could not regain the men's composure for some time. Each man shouted for salvation and deliverance from the hellish depths of the chasm. Thinking quickly, the stoic leader of the party reached into his valise and produced a Kodak Junior. He handed the camera to one of the men and instructed him to take, as best he could, photographs of the scene so that their surroundings could be examined by someone of authority. The flashbulbs popped in the midst of wild speculation from the other men. After the camera's film had been spent, the camera and the odd skull were placed in Mr. Kane's valise, and the crew continued on their circuit toward the exit with a bit more haste than before. This was when a new sensation became clear. Some of the party claimed to hear movement around them, which at first was dismissed as the echoes of the men's own footfalls upon the stone floor, but soon more and more men detected something else in the echoes of the cavern. The men were near hysteria, though none voiced his fear in an effort to trace the sounds that engulfed their minds in terror. No man was more than an arm's length away from another, all huddling close as they increased their speed. Then we heard the sounds of labored breathing, saturated with a liquescent, bubbling quality. All the men were now in full sprint to reach the upper world and escape the unknown menace that stalked them. The sound of miniature footfalls and the clacking of claws resonated louder and louder from all directions. Otherworldly moans soon gave way to sanity-rending screams from blasphemous throats, piping hideously into the ears of all the men. Two men at the rear of the group lost their footing, falling to the ground and slipping quickly from the light of the torches. None of the fleeing men stopped to retrieve their fallen companions, for the screams of those who had collapsed bespoke their fate. They cursed the demons that chased and hounded them, shrieking for blood. Glimpses of the creatures were caught as they darted in and out of the light's radius. One poor soul catching full view of one of the fiends clutched at his eyes and dropped his torch as he lapsed into hysterical fits upon the ground. One man dared look back at the scene that played out in the dying embers of the fallen torch, and never regained his sanity. Four of the original seven, including Mr. Kane, were left bounding through the darkness in a mad dash for the ropes. When they gained sight of the hanging lines, they scrambled up the stone structure that had been erected, though no sign of its builders remained. The madman, who had witnessed the evisceration of one of the fallen few, tripped the man beside him, ensuring his place on one of the three ropes. Three men ascended the lines while the silhouette of the fourth cast shadows from the discarded torches about the walls. There flickered upon the walls a macabre shadow play, too horrible to put into words. While the men climbed, they became aware of something unmistakable. The sections of ropes that swayed and swung below the workmen had become taut, as if they were now bearing the weight of other bodies under the climbers. The ascension was a blur of maddening screams and demoniacal howls, seeming to last an eternity. As the men gained the aperture, Mr. Kane shouted to the bystanders to cut the lines. The thick strands were severed and dropped out of sight quickly with the added weight of their inhuman pursuers. As the last rope dropped from sight, the three surviving members passed into unconsciousness, landing hard upon the great rock slab. Soon after, the men were revived, though one would only gibber and cackle to himself. Mr. Kane ordered the chamber cleared immediately of all personnel and equipment. More men were gathered from the ground levels, and everything was hauled from the pit within a few minutes. The great cleft in the slab was ordered sealed by dynamiting when sufficient distance had been put between it and the crew and material. Many gathered round Kane's disheveled and nervous figure, interrogating him about the state and whereabouts of the missing workers. All he could do was wring his hands and shout for updates on the dynamiting, his eyes never leaving the breach in the bedrock slab. His mind played for him a vision of those swarming imps of hell flowing out of inner earth, causing mass chaos and perpetrating unspeakable acts. He placed a hand on his valise and shuddered at what it contained. The hideous skull with its abominable teeth and abhorrent sockets that at one time held enormous eyes. Big images of the creatures ran through Mr. Kane's mind in a tidal wave of monstrously distorted shapes. Only in the slightest degree could he recall to himself what they had actually looked like. They were stunted, anthropomorphic fiends that could move on all four limbs as easily as two, with hairless bodies, predominantly gray, or at least appearing gray in the low-burning light of the torches. Parts of their bodies appeared scarred or even strangely rotten in places, possibly wounds dealt by another of their kind. It was here in the original account that hand-drawn sketches appeared. I consulted the yellowed pages of the manuscript to absorb the impressions these things had left on the man. Several coarse drawings were scattered about depicting these creatures. No two drawings were alike, although they shared similarities. The dissimilar quality delivered the impression neither of unclear recollection nor perhaps the lack of a distinct conception in the first place. Regardless, Any one of these caricatures of abnormal design was enough to send cold waves of fear washing over me. Other images included a rough sketch of the cave, detailed representations of stalactites dripping into dark puddles, and rendering of the scratches that had marked the floor and walls. After close inspection of these illustrations, I returned to my translation and read on. Within an hour, all bodies present were ordered back, as charges were set to close the chasm and bury all the progress done by the excavation teams. Most of the men had dispersed, returning home, considering the construction cancelled indefinitely. A few stragglers loafed about and pressed their hands to their ears in anticipation of the blast. Mr. Kane, his watchful eyes never faltering, stood and waited impatiently for the explosion that would once again trap those malignant beasts safely underground and away from the fragile minds of men. The cry of "Fire in the hole!" rang out. The plunger was pushed down, and the earth shook from the force of the blast. A few were shaken from their feet as dirt shifted and the ground quaked. The dust began to settle, and Mr. Kane was first to make a move toward the demolished site. Tons of loose earth occupied the former crevice that held within it something that had taken the lives of 7 men and the sanity of 1. He stomped around, making sure that no hidden pits or pockets could give way to a fresh opening. After tramping around, he felt satisfied for the moment, but ordered the site wetted and compacted as soon as possible. Mr. Kane knew that he was going to have to answer questions better left unanswered. The insistence of those around him became sterner regarding the missing men. He stammered something about a cave-in that had crushed the unaccounted men, and that it was imperative that the site be filled as quickly as possible to stem any further calamity. Deep fissures underground endangered the whole area, and had he not acted as he did, a massive cave-in would have claimed many more lives than it had already. By the time he finished explaining this to those who had witnessed the fall, many spectators from the populated area nearby had gathered around the site, as well as some local law enforcement. The area that the first station was to occupy was close to the outskirts of town, but far enough away from the town proper that the quake from the explosion had only enough force to rattle the windows of nearby houses. The police shuffled everyone off in the interest of safety. The next day, Mr. Kane hired a small crew to compact the earth. From then on, no man's hand would ever again disturb that soil. Of course, there was an inquest into the incident. Given time to complete his story regarding the event, it was ruled a matter of death by misadventure. Always a compassionate man, Mr. Kane paid the families of the deceased a monthly stipend until the time of his death. He never dared show the skull to anyone, though he would stare into its unblinking sockets and wonder what could have possibly spawned such a monster. No book of anthropology or zoology contained anything remotely like it. It was an unknown species, and should remain so, buried underground or eradicated from existence for its bestial behavior and bloodthirstiness. He kept this object in a velvet bag, placing it in the rear of one of his many display cases. The shelves being lined with many curios and relics assured no one would take interest in a nondescript velvet satchel. The photographs that were developed from the cave had inadvertently captured the likeness of those ghouls within their frames. Though blurry and obscured by the penetrating darkness of the cave, they were without a doubt the creatures that had given him and his men chase. These he would also study unendingly for their hints of the terrible. They often stirred in his breast feelings of retribution, the urge to traverse the void once more and exterminate those foul, gluttonous horrors. These moments were fleeting, however, as his courage was inevitably crushed by the petrifying fear delivered by the memory of his first encounter. Mr. Kane's health began failing him soon after, and he allied this happening with the idea that he had been exposed to some contagion born of the damp caves and cold air. Though I believe this to have been an unrelated malady, it taxed his body and nerves immensely, so that soon what may have been nothing less than a minor illness engulfed him, ravishing his body. The cadaverous color of his flesh disgusted him and denoted the extreme progression of his infirmity. Fearing infection, he grew more and more misanthropic, rarely seeing guests or even his own daughter. Toward the end of his life, the use of morphine became an increasingly serious habit. At first, he only made use of the opiate for sleep, but it soon drew him into its clutches as a hopeless slave. This was evident near the end of the manuscript, for often the sentences were jumbled and disjointed. In this manner, the narrative soon ended with no definite conclusion. I lowered my translated copy and leaned back in my chair. Could I possibly believe such a tale of madness? Surely there had been an attempt at building the subway, as attested by the documentation, but there must have been a reasonable explanation for its abandonment. This failure may well have been the cause of Mr. Kane's mental instability. The termination of this venture must have convinced him that he would not become the figure of note he was so ardent to become. That must have been the circumstance, for it may be that he had written this whole volume ensnared in morphine's grasp. Still, something gnawed at my brain, an insistence that there was some truth behind the disturbing tale. For nothing more than curiosity's sake, I decided I would ask Catherine a bit more about her father when next afforded the opportunity. For now, though, I would rest, for the twilight in which I began reading was now stark daylight. I decided I would sleep the remainder of the day away and arise the next morning to return to my job. Catherine visited the bank several times during the following week, and at each visit I would invite her out to dinner or a dance. She replied in the negative each time, explaining she had business matters to attend to or that she had already promised her time to a friend. She had sprightly suggested a meeting at the MASH the following Saturday, to which I cheerfully acquiesced. It was a full 5 days until that Saturday. My mind revolved, and I ruminated about all I had learned the week previous. I could scarcely keep my mind on my work and found myself making several mistakes, though fortunately not irreversible ones. Joseph commented on my slightly disheveled appearance and absent-mindedness on more than one occasion. He had offered an open and friendly ear, as if something were the matter. I told him that I would like nothing more than to unburden my mind upon him, but I could not, without first knowing for sure if it were at all a tangible dilemma. He seemed puzzled at my explanation, but once again offered himself as an outlet for what troubled me whenever I saw fit. I thanked him, and I went about the rest of my duties. Each night I would refuse to accompany friends to social events in order to spend time staring at the photographs. Could they have been manufactured as a prop in part of a greater hoax? Perhaps these were akin to the Cottingley Ferry photographs, which had even managed to sway Sir Arthur Conan Doyle to write The Coming of the Fairies. Surely Mr. Kane's photographs could be discounted as charlatanry as well, despite bearing convincing attributes. I had been able to calm my nerves by persuading myself of this fact. I would do my perfunctory questioning of Catherine, but I felt assured that it would find no evidence to corroborate the wilder aspects of that eccentric chronicle. With my mind eased slightly by my rational analysis, the remaining days passed without major incident, though I could not fully purge my mind of doubt. At 6 o'clock p.m. on Saturday, I sat in a booth at the MASH and waited for my lovely Catherine to arrive. Nursing a gin and tonic, I peered through the crowd of patrons in various states of inebriation for any sign of her arrival. I caught sight of a red cloche moving to and fro through the tangle of moving bodies. Recognizing her favorite hat, I called out to her and waved her toward my booth. My lips met her cheek and we exchanged warm greetings. Seating her and ordering her a drink, I sat opposite her, extending my hand to hers. Her blue eyes met mine, and I felt my heart beat faster in my breast. My face flushed. Her small hands were shrouded by mine as we sat and talked of life and dreams. My thoughts were of nothing but her as we spoke and laughed through the night. Given time, I was sure that she was the woman I would marry one day. That is, if I were to have it my way. The evening wore on while we dined and drank and laughed. Glancing at my watch, I saw now the hour was past 10, and it had hardly seemed as though a few minutes had passed. I was suddenly reminded of all I had wanted to ask her, so I looked for an appropriate opening to put forth my first question. During a lull, I brought up the subject of her father's manuscript and wondered if I might ask her a few questions about him. She agreed and was curious about what exactly had been in that text. I dared not tell her what I had found yet. I wanted proof confirming its authenticity or illegitimacy. Explaining it was merely an account of his travels, I posed my first question. I asked if she and her father had much contact in the months before his passing, and her response corroborated that of the text. She explained that during the latter part of his life, especially close to his demise, he had become withdrawn and taciturn. As often as not, he turned her away when she came to visit, though when he did admit her, their talks were trivial and superficial. He would say nothing of his health or of any business with her. I probed for a more specific time when he had begun to turn inwards. After a moment's thought, she could roughly guess that it was around the fall of 1921 when his strange reticence began to take hold. She said it must have been due to some ordeal involving legal issues, for he would spend long periods of time at the courthouse. There had been no explanation for her to this routine. He simply said it was a matter of business. This was also reflected in the manuscript, but was by no means proof of anything more than nervous strain. Remembering the vast collection of relics in glass shelves lining the large foyer of the mansion, I was interested in whether or not she had noticed a velvet bag toward the back of any of them. With a look of surprise, she had admitted to seeing such a bag. Peering through the glass at the weird collection of objects, she had noticed a blue velvet bag that seemed out of place amongst the other pieces of the collection. Upon hearing this, my heart skipped a beat and my palms became cold and clammy. As to whether or not she had touched the bag, she said she had not. It was out of place betwixt the antiques that shared the display with it, but with other matters at hand, her scrutiny of it was short-lived. I thanked merciful fate for providing her a distraction from what was hidden within that velvet packet. My mind reeled as I fought back impulses of fear. How could I survey the contents of that bag without her? What could I possibly do to convince her that I alone should cast my eyes upon whatever it may hold? Speaking quickly, before I could think, I told her that I must see what the satchel held and that I must do it alone. Cursing my impetuousness, I desperately tried to cover my tracks. Catherine plied me with questions about the manuscript, the bag, and what I had learned of her father. With a sigh, I suggested we leave the speakeasy to talk somewhere a little less crowded. We walked several blocks until we had reached a small park where I knew there would be no other visitors at this late hour. On an old wooden bench near a shallow stream, we sat in silence, not knowing where to begin. I asked if she remembered the photographs found in her father's safe deposit box, and asked if he had ever been interested in photography in any other than a casual way. She said he had carried a camera with him most times to document his interests and work, but he was by no means anything more than a novice with a device, nor did he own any equipment for developing. I thought of what those photographs had captured and shuddered. I looked into Catherine's eyes and knew it was inevitable that she learn the truth, so taking a deep breath, I told her all I had learned of her father and his final misadventure and entanglement with unbelievable, unspeakable things. Expressions of disbelief flashed wildly across her face as I recounted her father's hideous story, the cave-in, the deaths, the inquiry, and the state of her father's nerves and mind before he died. Words flowed from me as though they would never stop. All the while Catherine looked furtively about and bit at her lip. I knew she must have thought I was mad, for what sort of person could believe such things? It had taken just under an hour to recite all that I had come to know. When I had reached my summation, she sat quietly, staring into the middle distance. I waited for her to respond, but she remained still and silent. I broke the silence, proclaiming that we needed proof positive that this was either a brilliant piece of fiction or a terrible account of real events. She and I needed to open that bag and know what it held, if there was going to be any peace in the matter. Blinking hard and shaking her head, she spoke. Her sentiment of disbelief affirmed my assumption. She thought me mad, but she agreed that we should see this enigma through. We hailed a cab and directed the driver to Catherine's mansion on Empire Street. We exited the cab and approached the mansion in silence. My heart beat like hummingbird wings as she opened the door leading to the grand foyer. Catherine had no recollection inside which case she had seen the bag. There were many to choose from, so we split up, each taking opposite sides of the room. Each case had been built with electric lights shining down on the ghastly objects like miniature spotlights. We searched high and low, for there was indeed much ground to cover. As I knelt down to inspect the cabinet filled with crude spears or arrowheads, I heard Catherine call my name. I walked up beside her and looked upon an object that held more mystery to me than the Ark of the Covenant. Neither of us reached for the bag at first. We only stared at it, waiting for the other to make the first move. I clasped my hands together and looked over at Catherine, whose complexion was that of a ghost. After the passing of what felt like many lifetimes, I reached out and grasped the drawstring of the bag. Whatever was inside was lighter than I had anticipated, which filled me with mixed emotions. I dared not touch any part of the bag itself, carrying it toward the dining room table, with Catherine in tow. I placed the bag gingerly on the table between the chairs where Catherine and I had sat. Again, we lapsed into an inactive state, eyeing the bag suspiciously, afraid of what it might contain. It became clear that I was going to be the one responsible for any progress, as Catherine seemed unable to bear the stress of the situation. I closed my eyes and breathed deeply, steeling myself for whatever I should find. Reaching slowly, I clasped the drawstring of the bag and loosened the opening, not yet seeing its contents. My hands, clammy with sweat, froze, and I could not make them move to undress the object before us. Then, with one quick motion, I pulled the velvet satchel away from the thing. Catherine at once swooned, her head landing upon her arm on the table after seeing the horrible thing staring back at her with its gaping, empty sockets. It gleamed white and spectral under those burning electric lights, with a half-grin and missing mandible. Sitting before us, deathly silent, was the marred skull of a creature akin to those that had chased her father through the hellish spans of a hidden grotto. I placed the skull back into the bag before rousing Catherine from her fainting spell. I then led her up to her room and put her to bed before gathering up the bag and heading out into the dark streets. At a building under construction, I stopped, its frame looming like a skeleton in the moonlight. I placed the bag on a large rock and, with a nearby sledgehammer, smashed the skull into powder. The next morning, hearing a knock on my door, I found Catherine in a terrible state. I invited her in and made some tea to calm her nerves. In murmured and hushed tones, she described the horrible experience she had had the night before, terrible nightmares where she and her father were pursued by impish denizens of hell. They tore at her father's flesh and chased her tirelessly through black voids and swirling abysses of terror. I assured her that it was merely a dream, that she should not take stock in what her sleeping mind created. But this was not all, she said, for she had awakened in the night after the terrible dream, and something else troubled her. Some odd things had happened to her previously, though she had paid them no mind at the time. Now, with this new and horrible revelation, she had begun to wonder if such things had significance. I was puzzled at what she hinted at and inquired as to what events she now saw malignity in. Shortly after moving into her father's mansion, she told me, odd noises echoed about the house at night. Creaking windows, quiet scratching on the glass, bumps on the roof or in the cellar, all these things she had observed and concluded were nothing more than the old building shifting in its foundation, as time had surely taken its toll on the old place, or perhaps animals that had invaded and were rattling around in search of food. Now, however, these happenings had taken on a sinister cast. Last night held within it a far more insidious quality than these nocturnal sounds, or even her nightmare. What had awoken her from her slumber was a clatter from outside her window. Something had stolen upon her in the night and peered through the glass. It was quick, moving behind the pane so swiftly that she had not been able to even catch a glance of its figure. This was not all that had troubled her this morning, though, for in the early hours, as the sun peeked over the horizon, she received news regarding her father's grave. It had apparently been tampered with. Someone had dug into the earth where her father had lain, and clumsily tried to repack the earth in an attempt to hide their crime. When the grave was excavated to ascertain what had been stolen, they found the coffin had been destroyed as though something had burst through it, and the body of her father was gone. Incidentally, she had heard that the houses of some of her father's former workers had been broken into, reputedly only the workers who had been in the lower site and not on the groundworks. Several people had been attacked and killed in a most gruesome way during these invasions. The intruders had seemingly not been after money or valuables, for nothing was missing, and only mangled bodies were left in the wake of the break-ins. Oddly, not all of the bodies could be accounted for, and of the ones left behind there seemed to have been parts removed, or even eaten. The implications of this news sent my mind reeling into dark abysses of horror. Had these things erupted from the ground and tracked Catherine down? Furthermore, what of these ghastly attacks on the workmen's families, and why only the families of the men who had witnessed the cave-in? Something needed to be done about what was happening. The murders and the grave-robbing gave the town's gossip-mongers endless subject matter. The recent events were on everybody's lips, and they had cast long stares in Catherine's direction during her trip to my apartment. I was sure that Catherine's life was in grave danger, and though I knew not from what, she needed my protection. I told her that she would stay and sleep in my bed while I took the sofa. I couldn't risk her staying in that old mansion of her father's. In the meantime, I would gather as much information as I could from the townspeople. I also decided I would need some help and could think of no one better suited for the job than my good friend Joseph Warren. As I set to work gathering all I could of the gossip around the town, I learned that the subway disaster was not all that far from the town's collective mind as I had at one time thought. People whispered of it and explained in hushed tones about a conspiracy to do away with all those involved. Even though Mr. Kane had died, he must have laid plans to tie up all loose ends. The reasons for this theory were wild and varied. Some said Mr. Kane had found a deposit of gems or precious metals and intended on keeping them all to himself, whilst others guessed that he had murdered the missing workers in a fit of sudden rage. Most people's rationale for this was the repugnant nature of the slayings the night before. I heard more and more of these fantastic yarns as I traveled around the town, asking comers and goers what they had heard, though none were as unbelievable as the apparent truth. I needed to find Joseph, for surely two sound minds could disentangle what was going on and figure a way out of it. I found Joseph at his home at 11:30 that morning. He was in fine spirits and greeted me warmly as he invited me inside, though his demeanor changed when he saw the awful state I was in. Ushering me to a chair and pouring me a glass of brandy, he asked what was wrong with me. I downed the brandy in one swallow and asked for another, telling him I would need to build my courage up for what I was about to tell him. I thought he could never believe such a story as the one I was going to divulge, but I begged him to listen and understand me as a friend. Sitting across from me, he wore an expression of concern and bid me to tell him what the matter was. I began to pour out all that happened regarding Catherine's father, the subway, the manuscript, the photographs, the skull, Mr. Kane's grave, and the murders. Finally, I revealed my theory that the recent slayings were a result of some malign trigger or happenstance that had allowed these blasphemous creatures to penetrate the boundary of those damnable collision's depths and attain the surface. I must have sounded like a madman, for Joseph rose and placed his hands firmly on my shoulders. My ramblings stirred something in him, and he looked at me in earnest, asking if I believed all the things I had told him. I affirmed in all sincerity that all I had said I believed without a doubt. Grabbing his coat, he pulled me to my feet and said that I must show him the manuscript and all the other articles related to this subterranean horror. I sheepishly admitted to destroying the skull, that I could not let such a thing exist for anyone else's eyes to fall upon. Though he lamented my actions, he was no less resolute to learn all he could. Back at my apartment, Joseph frantically turned the pages of my translation and flipped through the photographs of those distorted figures. Shocked beyond words, Joseph sat with Catherine and I in silence, not knowing what could be done to stem further possible invasions. I wondered aloud why there hadn't been any activity until now. Why hadn't these things come shortly after the cave-in? Why had they only now chosen to stalk the town, killing the innocent workmen and their families? Joseph asked if there had been any sign of other humans in the cave beforehand, or whether or not it was mentioned to have been near any structure inhabited or otherwise. I told him that the spot was chosen for its isolation, should there have been a need for blasting. As Mr. Kane's writing had said, the only thing even remotely near it was one of the town's cemeteries. Resting his hands on his chin, Joseph thought for a moment, and then with a start he asked Catherine what cemetery her father had been buried in. It was indeed the very one that sat within a stone's throw of the demolished site. An idea hit me with the force of a genuine blow. There had been a heavy rain the night before the grave had been found disturbed. The water must have seeped through the earth into the dank void, carrying with it the essence and scent of her father's body. These abominations, having spent the entirety of their lives underground, must have developed a keen sense of smell to hunt for nourishment in the blackness. They must have undoubtedly recognized the scent and clawed through the earth and eviscerated the corpse. This also explained why the break-ins and slayings had taken place in the middle of the night. Those enormous eyes would be well suited to the low light of the town after nightfall, but during the daylight hours would doubtlessly be blinded by the harsh rays of the sun. It was all coming together. They had needed to seal the aperture when dawn came, as not to be accosted by stark daylight. This painted a grim picture for the night ahead. These squat, bestial abnormalities would unquestionably rise again to unleash their furies upon more innocent people. The hour was now just after 2 p.m. There was not much time to formulate and enact a solid plan of action. We shouted frantically for a sound solution and were inevitably left with only one option. Joseph and I were to gather weapons and supplies and lay siege to these fiends, wiping them from existence. Catherine insisted she be counted as one of the party, to which I strongly protested. I would never let her enter into such a dangerous situation. Mr. Kane was her father, she said, and if action would be taken, it was going to include her. I begrudgingly conceded and gave her and Joseph a short list of items to procure. We were to meet back at my apartment in 2 hours' time. By 4:15, we convened back at my apartment with most of the supplies in tow. Through certain channels, I was able to obtain a military-style flamethrower and 3 automatic pistols. Joseph carried a long coil of rope, climbing spikes, and electric lanterns. Catherine brought a long reel of twine, spades, and a pickaxe. We knew that we must make haste, for soon the daylight would wane into twilight. While Joseph loaded his motor car, I spoke to Catherine of my concerns and deep love for her. I did not want to see her come to any harm and begged her again to reconsider accompanying us. I was not brave or heroic in any form, but I told her this needed to be done, though she needn't risk herself in the process. My feelings of love for her were more than returned. However, she would not revise her earlier decision to aid us. I sighed in resignation and escorted her to the waiting automobile. Driving to the cemetery seemed to take eons, as we all feared what was to come. My hands trembled when the graveyard drifted into view. Large cypress and willow trees, hanging giant limbs with leaves cascaded down. Tears, mourning the dead. The auto rolled to a stop outside the cast iron gates that gleamed like the teeth of a giant waiting to ingest us. Joseph shut off the motor with a deep sigh, and we gazed at one another. We knew that nothing would be the same after this. Nothing would be as it once was. The world as we knew it had grown to include the terrible and macabre. My heart pounded in my ears as my clammy palms reached for the door handle. I faltered and turned back to Catherine, telling her once more of my love for her. She returned my love and kissed me softly. Leaving the car, Joseph opened the trunk and we gathered our supplies. Each of us took up a pistol, climbing spikes, and a lantern. Catherine lifted the rope and reel of twine as I adjusted the flamethrower on my back. Each of us carrying a digging implement, we entered the burial ground, heading for the recently disturbed grave. This particular ossuary, lying on the outskirts of the town, all but promised our ghastly task would go unobserved. Toward the back of the grounds, the sepulchre was easy to spot by the elaborate tombstone Mr. Kane had commissioned for himself. Joseph, being of tougher fiber than myself, took to swinging the pickaxe as Catherine and I cleared the dirt from the expanding hole. Speed was of the essence, for although we did not know when in the night the ghouls had made their move, we had but a few precious hours of daylight left for the task. We removed our jackets and wiped sweat from our brows. Before long, we struck wood. Clearing away the disturbed earth, we beheld that indeed the coffin had been clawed or crashed through as if hit by a battering ram. As we stood staring in disbelief, the ground quaked and started to give way. The earth caved in just as we sprang from the hole, clawing at the grass and crawling from the sinking loam. Dusting ourselves off, we stood before a sizable rift leading down to dark chasms of untold horror. I tied one end of the rope to the trunk of a large cypress tree and hurled the length of it into the pit. We gathered up our gear, save for the shovels and pick, and Catherine attached the reel of twine to her belt. The three of us all took up the rope, descending into the hollow, Joseph going first, me second, and Catherine third. The darkness engulfed us, and panic gripped me like a vice. The electric lanterns were set burning, and we continued downward, seeing no sign of a bottom. Hideous claw marks covered the wall in front of us. Gouges were made in the solid stone strata, passing before our eyes like hieroglyphs in a mummy's tomb. All at once I recognized the pungent odor which the men had employed handkerchiefs to mask. It filled my nose and turned my stomach, making my innards churn in disgust. They had not exaggerated when they described this emanation as detestable and evil, for it carried behind it a hint of the nefarious. When we gained sight of a stone slab beneath us, I felt relief that we had actually found a footing, for the descent had been interminable. The added weight of the flamethrower had made my arms scream with fatigue, and I was afraid that if we hadn't reached a substratum before long, they would give out. We gained our footing and shined our lanterns about, looking for any sign of the abhorrent beings. There were no signs of life in any direction. The only evidence that they had even been there were the scrapes we had seen on our way down. Here in the substructure of the cave, the odor waxed unbearable, and something in this odor must have been the culprit that hindered the workmen's burning torches. It seemed difficult even to breathe such noxious vapors. Catherine drove a small spike into the wall and tied the twine from the reel to it. The twine would serve as a guideline to prevent us from becoming hopelessly lost within this jagged labyrinth, where I knew we faced something infinitely more terrible than the fabled Minotaur. Joseph directed our attention towards our feet, and Catherine gasped at what we saw. All about the ground beneath us were capacious smears of burgundy. Dried blood spread out from us in all directions, for yards. This must have been all that was left of those unaccounted for from the previous night's attacks. Every fiber of my being wanted nothing more than to quickly ascend the rope and cover this portal to hell. I stood my ground and in a shaky voice suggested we get a move on, for we hadn't much time. The reel on Catherine's belt clicked softly as we walked, counting off the distance we traveled. We minded our footfalls, keeping as quiet as possible, for if we were to make a go of destroying these things, we would need to catch them off guard. My keen ears listened for any sound, but only perceived the quiet echoes of dripping water into puddles that dotted the floor. The cave seemed endless, turning this way and that. With no signs of life save our own, my confidence began to return in minuscule amounts. The nozzle of the flamethrower no longer shook in my hands, and I looked at Catherine, showing her an expression of assurance as we traipsed on. According to my pocket watch, we had been on the move for over an hour, still with no indicator we were even on the right track. We rounded a corner, and I was just about to suggest we take a rest when something queer caught my eye. A large boulder perched over a crest of unknown depth. The boulder itself seemed singular in that it was a type of rock we had not yet encountered in our sojourn. It was composed of some greenish soapstone with gold flecks that reflected my lantern's light. I wandered over the rim where the boulder sat to further examine the rock when something I saw caused me to drop to the ground, extinguishing my lantern. I covered my mouth to muffle a scream and felt as though my mind would unhinge and would fall into a spiraling madness from what I beheld. Joseph and Catherine saw the scene I was making and began walking in my direction. I desperately threw my hand up to halt their progress, waving them from the edge. They backed away slowly. I held my finger to my lips to shush any sounds they might make, and turned my head back in the direction of what had threatened my sanity. There, in a smooth crater of sorts, was a sea of writhing, snarling, squat, moaning beasts. The dome lid over the crater was coated in some bizarre phosphorescent algae or moss, shining a sickly green light down upon the masses. I couldn't believe my eyes. The impish abominations were hideous and rotten. Huge black eyes rolled about in their heads, and gnashing teeth shone as though there were no lips to conceal them. They walked hunched over on stunted and malformed legs terminating in prehensile-looking claws. Watching the throng, I was witness to several acts of cannibalism as the larger specimens turned to devour the smaller of their kind. At odd intervals, one of the beasts would stand erect and emit a blood-curdling scream, stretching out its detestable limbs. When they did so, I could see they possessed a flap of what I can only call skin, stretching between the upper and lower limbs. These rugose membranes reminded me of a bat's wings, though immeasurably more sickening. Having neither ears nor nose to speak of, their heads were nearly perfect spheres, save for those ghastly, over-protuberant eyes. The loathsome orbs that rolled within their sockets were solid black, without a hint of iris or sclera. I lay rigid with fear upon the gravel with my hands pressed to my face, fighting back convulsive screams, knowing that any sound would alert the horde to our presence, which would surely spell the end, not only to us but to the people of the town above. My heart, a jackhammer in my chest, pounded so loud I was petrified that they could hear its thudding in my chest. I covered my eyes and, as silently as I could, slithered backwards away from the rim of the caldera. I must have disturbed the delicate foundation of the boulder, however, for moments after I'd begun my timorous crawl backwards, I felt the shifting of some mammoth object. I opened my eyes in time to catch a glimpse of the colossal stone shifting and, finally, plummeting down the sloped edge of the Cyclopean stone bowl. Pure panic exploded in my brain as I scrambled to my feet, shouting for Joseph and Catherine to run. They had not bothered to ask why, for at that very moment, a chaotic cacophony of screams shattered the silence. The boulder could be heard plunging downward, colliding with other rocks, and finally landing amidst that sea of monstrosity, rolling over the dwarfed figures unimpeded. Our flight through the cave was madness itself. Nothing could be heard above the shrieking demons. We ran along the twine guide, not looking back for even a second. Large rocks and masses of earth jutting from the walls bruised and battered our bodies. Yet we paid no heed to the pain. We knew we would be overtaken. The sound of scraping claws and screeching mouths waxed louder and louder. I could think of nothing more than being eviscerated by that pursuing army of the damned. At the head of the group, I called a full stop, turning to face our pursuers, lighting the igniter of the flamethrower where I stood, trembling, waiting for the first sign of movement. The pandemonium grew in volume, and in the distance I saw dark figures moving with incredible agility. I unfurled a wall of flames in the direction of the beasts. I built between us and them a barrier of fire, and they moaned and screamed and covered their lidless eyes with their distorted paws. Joseph and Catherine fired their pistols at the abhorrent brutes, though there was not nearly enough ammunition to effect any substantial decrease in their numbers. The bullets were spent in no time, leaving only the flames as our shield, but by the weight of the apparatus I could tell that my fuel would not last much longer. I instructed Joseph to lift the tanks off of me as I continued to lay down cover. I begged them to run, leaving me to fend them off as long as I possibly could, but they both refused. I dropped the nozzle of the flamethrower, with the valve stuck open, in the direction of the oncoming savages. The remainder of fuel and propellant in the tanks, I hoped, would sustain the diminishing inferno and afford us a few precious moments to make an escape. We turned and continued running as the flames subsided and the things regained their morbid object. We still had some distance to go before we would reach the rope, and our shrieks of panic-stricken horror were muted by the sounds made by the fiends. Nothing could be heard over the notes that piped from those nauseous throats. I turned my head to see how Catherine fared, and the spot she recently occupied next to me was vacant. Stopping in my tracks and reeling around to see what had become of her, I saw that she had become entangled in the twine that's reel still resided on her belt. No sooner had I turned to see her than the diminutive gray beasts were upon her. Her mouth formed unheard pleas for rescue, and her eyes grew wide with fear. I drew my pistol, but could not move a muscle either to fire the gun or run to her aid. I could only watch as the terrors that led the horde descended upon her, tearing at her, ripping sinewy strips of flesh from her body and devouring them. Her blue eyes never left me as I stood, impotent, tears running in streams down my cheeks. Those repulsive creatures ripped her limb from limb. Joseph had finally noticed mine and Catherine's absence, and I turned back, gripping my forearm and pulling me onward. Madness had taken me, and I laughed maniacally through the dark abyss, though no one heard it. We finally made the rope, and Joseph thrust me toward it, heaving me into the air. I began climbing. We scaled the claw-gouged wall faster than I think any man alive might. The detestable feeling of slack rope gone taut beneath us petrified me. The length of rope jostled while the abhorrent climbers gained on us. In my frantic climb, I looked down in horror. Further down the rope, Joseph had been overtaken by the things. He swung his arms around violently, trying to shake off the deformed hellions as they clawed at his face and tore his flesh. Still clenching the pistol in my hand, I fired at his attackers, hitting several. Their numbers seemed unending.
Two ghouls replaced every one I had killed. Joseph's grip slackened and he plunged from sight into the black void as more and more of the beasts clung to him. Thinking quickly, I withdrew my penknife and slashed at the rope. Within seconds, I had sawn completely through it, and it too was pulled from my sight. This ploy, however, would not stop them, for at that very moment I could hear the crumbling and scraping of stone as they scaled the wall after me. I renewed my climb with vigor, screaming in terror and begging for deliverance from this legion of hell. I could see weakened light streaming in from the opening above, and I redoubled my efforts at ascension. My escape was but mere yards away, but I could feel those things beneath me. Sharp talons slashed at my ankles, and all at once I knew they were closer than I had expected. I gained the ground, pulling myself into the fresh air and growing sunlight. I took up a spade and swung it above my head, planning to beat back the onslaught as best I could. The sun was three quarters over the horizon, and I took aim, ready to swing. A few of the more daring creatures extended their heads from the aperture, and I brought the tool down hard and swift upon them. Soon the sun's feeble rays were enough to keep them at bay. Screams of frustration and anger bellowed from beneath the earth. There cut through the cacophony the sound of an enormous rift. All was silent for a few moments. Then again came a sound as of two mountains colliding. All the slimy bodies clawing and ripping into the substructure must have weakened it severely, for in the next instant the ground trembled and quaked as though the surrounding terrain were about to be swallowed up in cataclysmic tremor. I ran for the iron gate of the cemetery, wanting to get as far away from that damnable pit as possible. An earth-rending crack sounded, knocking me from my feet and toppling many moss-covered tombstones. The cemetery was caving in, pulling everything on the surface with it. I regained my footing and continued running, bounding over crumbling stones and sinking crypts. I leaped through the iron gates, landing hard, hitting my head upon a stone and losing consciousness. I awoke to the sounds of crickets and the smell of night air. For a moment, I was able to perceive all that had happened as a terrible nightmare. I raised my head and saw a rock covered in my own blood. All at once it came back to me, and I rolled over to take in all that was left of the old cemetery. What met my eyes was surprisingly little. All that stood now was the twisted form of the fallen iron gates. An area of acres now lay a full foot beneath the surrounding land. No evidence of the old graveyard existed. A barren area devoid even of trees stretched before me. The cave-in must have been complete, and perhaps even shifted two titanic masses of earth together, sealing those blasphemies deep within the earth's bowels. Catherine's face flashed before my mind's eye, and I fell back to the ground, yelling to a god I knew had never existed. My voice grew hoarse from cries of agony, and tears streamed down my face. Those blasted demons of inner earth had robbed Catherine of her soul, and me of my love. I cursed all forces of gods and nature for the injustice I had suffered, and cursed myself for having done nothing to save her from that overwhelming army of ghouls. And Joseph, a hapless casualty of my misguided exploits. Why did I ever take an interest in that damned manuscript? In the weeks that followed, my nerves told on me, and I could not go into the bank vault without succumbing to fear-driven fits from which I was not easily roused. As a consequence, I lost my job and could not secure another. My savings dwindled, and my mind played more and more tricks on me. Stoking a fire, I decided to burn the manuscript and the photographs so that no one else could let their curiosity rule them as I had. It was then I had myself committed to an asylum, hoping the alienists could straighten out my tangled nerves and make sense of life to me. I pleaded for understanding and pointed to the vacant lot where once the cemetery lay. I asked them of the whereabouts of Joseph and Catherine and of the failed subway. They only laughed at me. The cemetery had been swept under by some unknown body of water, they said. Some concealed river simply had eroded the substructure beneath the grounds, not to mention the obvious damage done by the blasting of the hole. There was no evidence of foul play in the disappearances of the two I had mentioned, for
Perhaps they had even run off together. As for the subway, it was merely the failed business venture of a man too driven by his desires. What then had happened to the man committed after the incident? He surely could shed some light on the events of the day. The man had witnessed these beings in action, and I inquired as to his whereabouts. The man I had spoke of had apparently died shortly after his arrival to the asylum, having died in the throes of an hysterical fit. During the night, my diseased brain overwhelmed me with delusions. I could hear scratching at my windows and feel the stare of bulbous black eyes peering at me from all angles. Those subterranean devils had tracked by smell before. What stopped them from doing it again? No, it couldn't be. They had all been crushed by tons of stone and earth. Nevertheless, the lights in my room blazed through the night, for I thought them my only protection. My screams for help in the twilight hours were soon only met with a needle and strong sedative. I needed out of the asylum, for if the things did come, there would be no hope for me if I were sedated. With a false portrayal of mental stability, I checked myself out of the asylum and started moving from boarding house to boarding house, staying in whatever establishment my meager savings would afford me. But the scratching did not stop. The moans of those alien throats sounded low under the wind when the sun went down. Even now as I write this, I hear them, lurking just outside my room. They stalk me endlessly, but never leave a trace. I do not wish to suffer the same fate as my love and my best friend, and lastly I have taken precautions. The pistol I procured the day of the horror had never left my possession. I hid it when I had gone into the asylum, but retrieved it upon my discharge. Those foul, stunted abnormalities that have festered below the earth crust for countless ages would not get the satisfaction of taking me alive. In this very room, my neurotic compulsion drove me to carve a likeness of the scratches and gouges the fiends had made in underground stone on the walls and floor around me. The wind howls through the trees outside, partially masking their moans. My candles have burned nearly to the end, and there is no electricity in this building. I have nothing to shield me from their advances. The flames blink out, one by one. Soon it will be as black as pitch.
The last candle sputters out. The scratching at the window. They are coming. But I will not be their victim. I love you, Catherine.